Hey there, folks. This is Screen Watching. My name is Dan Barrett, joined here, as always, by my co-host, Simon Foster. Oh, okay, wait. No. Sorry, guys. Elephant in the room. I need to address this before the podcast gets started. So look, during the week, well, last Friday, recorded the podcast, published it, Simon pushed it out into the world, did a little bit of the social media promotion that he's famous for doing. Pushed out the podcast to the hundreds of thousands of listeners to this podcast, and we end up getting a response from a person on Twitter, goes by the name of Menas, if that is their real name. Who can even say with these internet people? Anyway, Menas drops in this little nugget of, I guess it was praise. I feel he meant it, or they meant it that way. They said, love the podcast. Problem is, Dan is a bit of a prick. And as such, he hate watches it. Now, look, fine, fair enough. But the things that you need to understand is this. One, I don't suffer fools lightly. Two, I host a podcast with Simon Foster. Folks, do the math. Anyway, guys, before we get started on the podcast, I feel it's incumbent upon me to do the top five grouches, incalcitrants, whatever you want to say. Look, we'll say it, pricks. The top five pricks from film and television. Here we are, the official list. Number five, Larry David, the character from Curb Your Enthusiasm, not the man. The man might be a bit of a prick. He did attack Elmo on the TV during the week. So who can really say for sure? Number five, Larry David. Number four, Oscar the Grouch, another Muppet. Number three, the character of Miles from Sideways. Number two, Statler from Statler and Waldorf fame. And of course, number one, the bigger prick on the list, Waldorf. Folks, that is the official list of pricks. This is Screen Watching. We're getting started.
This is not like TV, only better.
Television! Teacher! Mother!
Secret lover.
What, that's it? That's your movie?
Well, I said that I had an idea for a movie.
Hey folks, this is Screen Watching. My name's Dan Barrett. Dan, the real prick Barrett. Joined here by Simon, the innocent bystander Foster. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you're listening to us from. Welcome to Screen Watching. I think you're selling yourself short. You could have very easily made that top five list if Mr. Menner's opinion is anything to go by. Hey, it might be the whole internet for all I know. Good to be here, Dan Barrett. There's a lot to talk about on this week's Screen Watching. Let's run through the review titles, this thing you do where you tell everyone what's coming up. I love this part of the show.
Oh, look, it is definitely, when people think about what's their favorite part of this podcast, they go, you know what, the bit where it all just happens before it falls apart, and that's where we're at. First of all, I'm going to talk about Let's Talk About Chew. It's a new Netflix TV series. Simon is going to talk about the eagerly anticipated Australian movie called Force of Nature, The Dry 2. How often is it that anything gets referred to as a highly anticipated Australian movie? Happens never. Not since Crocodile Dundee 2 has that phrase been uttered. My question, why is it called Force of Nature the Dry 2? Is Force of Nature not enough? Is it that they don't want to get mixed up with the Ben Affleck Sandra Bullock film from 2002? 98? Whenever that was. Who knows? Simon will explain all. Simon's also going to talk about a new feature called Rice Boy Sleeps. I presume it's not a fetish video, but we'll find out. I've got a few thoughts on the Curb Your Enthusiasm season 12 final season premiere. And then finally, Simon's going to take a look at Orion and the Dark. And as always, we're doing This Week in History. We're doing some birthday quiz. And wait for it, there's an intermission this week. But you can't get to any of that until we play a little sting to get started with the reviews.
It stinks.
All right, let's kick things off with this apparently highly anticipated new Australian film, Force of Nature, The Dry 2. It's a terrible title. It's all punctuation and numbers, and it's a terrible way to write a film title. But I think it's highly anticipated mostly by roadshow films who are desperate for a hit in the cinemas, having... since lost the Warner Brothers contract a couple of years ago, it's been a pretty lean run from the giant, iconic Australian studio / distributor. And The Dry, a couple of years ago, the Robert Connolly film that introduced us to the character of Aaron Falk, as played by one Eric Banner, which was a big hit for them. They've been very keen to get this film out there. It was due to come out middle of last year. Then it was pushed to late last year, and because of the writer's strike, it's finally been pushed to this week.
Alice has been on her own for more than 30 hours.
Why did she call you? A couple of feds out of their natural habitat.
Daniel Bailey, you work with Alice?
She's a very highly regarded member of our team.
No mobile phones. You need a social media free weekend, ladies.
You'll survive.
The Dry was a film that certainly got a lot of acclaim. It was a very sturdy bit of Australian filmmaking, one of those outback noir films. The character of Aaron Falk seemed to suit Banner in the original film. He returns in this movie to investigate the death of a woman who went on a retreat with some executives from her work. They got lost in the bush, and the woman, played by Anna Torv, and I'll come back to her performance later, passes away. And there's a lot of to-ing and fro-ing and tensions within the group that sort of blur, was it an accident, wasn't it an accident, and so on and so forth, in that classic sort of cop mystery procedural sort of TV movie kind of a way. Also in the mix is the fact that this is the same part of the world that Aaron Falk's mother, the detective's mother, passed away many years ago when he was a young boy. That's a direct link back to the first film, in which when Aaron Falk's character returned to the outback, it was to investigate the death of someone in a dry bed creek where one of his friends died many years ago. Apparently the lesson in these films is don't go into the bush with Aaron Falk, because terrible things will happen to you. That aspect of the story is very much tacked on in the way that it is presented by director Robert Connolly, who returns for the sequel. The other elements that play into the narrative, which is split into three parts, are Banner's investigation and his relationship with his partner, played by the terrific Jacqueline McKenzie, and flashbacks to the women as they make their way through the forest, through the bush, and leading to the death of Anna Torv, which isn't a spoiler. If you've seen the trailers, you'll have some idea what's going on. All of these are very disparate elements that don't come together in the film at all. It is all set in this beautiful bushland, which is not captured particularly well by the cinematography. And the story elements, it really does start to feel like an Eric Banner TV pilot cop show after a while. There's very little atmosphere created. There is an overbearing soundtrack which tells you exactly what's going on and exactly how to feel, in only the way that a lot of Australian films do that. I've seen a lot of those lately where it's just too much music, too heavy-handed in the way they try to tell you how you meant to feel at this part of the film. And Banner himself seems a little bit lost in this character. He doesn't do anything particularly interesting with the part. He has a very stoic face throughout. In one major sequence, in which the two suspects to the killing are provided with some dialogue to sort of flesh out the mystery, he stands by and watches. These are the big scenes that a producer of the film, and Banner is one of the producers, would give the star to really work on. But he didn't want to step up and do that. He left it to two young actresses who do a good enough job, but they're not Eric Banner, and they're not the star of the film. I just thought this was a very flavorless, not particularly interesting murder mystery that really overstays its welcome as well. So unfortunately, Force of Nature, The Dry 2 will probably open really well at the box office, but I don't know if word of mouth is going to be in this film's corner. It is not a Force of Nature box office-wise.
Yeah. Is it better or worse than the Ben Affleck, Sandra Bullock film?
From what I remember of that, it was similarly caned by critics at the time, but found a bit of an afterlife on home video. It is about the same, frankly.
Well, I hope that makes it onto the movie poster. Look, I keep on seeing the trailer for this before I see other feature films at Brisbane's Angelica Theatre, which is my go-to destination of late. The trailer for it, I always find myself like really invested in the trailer, thinking, oh, I remember wanting to go and see this. And then Eric Banner comes up and I remember it's The Dry 2, which is a film. I didn't see The Dry 1, so I don't know if I'd be lost in this or not. I suspect not. And the one thing that I have is that, one, I'd like to see this movie, I think. But also, it does feel like a TV movie, and there seems to be no difference really between this and, say, like Rebecca Gibney starring as Halifax FP.
That's a great comparison. That's exactly the comparison you should make, because it's very much like that. And I did say I'd come back to Anna Torv's performance. She is the one sort of shining light. She's the one character in this who sparks whenever she's on screen. She has a big history with the company that's put the retreat on for their executives, and she has a lot of dynamics going on with the five of them on the trek. None of which is really explored, and it falls back a lot on Anna Torv's really fine performance to flesh out any tension in the group, which she does, but it's just not exploited by Connolly, who's, you know, Connolly makes really good films when he can just delve into character, and he did a great job on that with Balibo, and he sort of got it right with The Dry, although I wasn't a huge fan of the film. But with this one, it's all this cumbersome, convoluted narrative that he just doesn't seem to handle very well. He doesn't give himself any really strong characters to latch onto and find really interesting aspects of. So this very much feels like a director for hire, which it shouldn't, because he directed the first one and he's one of the producers along with Banner. So this seems like a mismatch of material and filmmaker.
Yeah, like I certainly think that Robert Connolly is competent as a filmmaker, but he certainly, I don't think he's ever lived up to the expectation that we all saw in him from Balibo. And I don't know he's made a good movie since Balibo. Yeah, I said it, putting it out there.
No, Simon Foster. I don't disagree with that. I think, like I say, I think you're right. I think he's competent is the word. This is a competent film. It's not like you won't come out of this either way, sort of loving it to the all ends of the earth or particularly hating it. It's just a competent bit of time waster, and I think it could have been a lot more, especially in this age where you look around and there's great sort of murder mysteries on screen, Anatomy of a Fall is everywhere at the moment. It's essentially a murder mystery. And when you compare it, and it may be not fair to compare it to something like that, but when you do, it's not a shade.
Yeah, it was before I saw that movie that I saw this trailer, one of the last things I saw. Yeah, really just didn't compare. The other thing, I guess, is Anna Torv. You mentioned her in here. Like, I think that Anna Torv is hugely underrated in terms of Australian actors. She's definitely having a little bit of a moment at the moment, having starred in the Australian drama The Newsreader, and she's certainly been picked up there. But, like, you think about some of the recent roles over the last 10 years. So her appearing in Secret City, which is a really underrated Australian mini from a few years back, but then also is one of the leads of David Fincher's Mindhunter series as well, where I thought she was just exceptional in that program. When she's got the material, she absolutely meets the challenge of it, which I think is, I don't know. I just find myself lost in her every time.
Force of Nature, The Dry 2 from Roadshow Films is out in very wide release this week. They've put nothing up against it, which isn't unusual in the doldrums that are the February sort of movie-going period. But let's hope it brings people out of their houses. I hope it's a huge success for them, because I'd like to see a franchise get born out of the Australian film industry. It's been a while. So Force of Nature, Dry 2 in cinemas now.
Okay, Simon, I've got a foreign language TV program. I'm going to do the blurb on it before we play a clip, so hopefully it's a bit contextualized. Here's the log line for the program. And tell me you don't want to watch this program based on the log line. Here we go. Vlogger Chu AI uses her channel to talk frankly about sex. However, in real life, she finds the subject much more sensitive than when she tackles it in her videos, as she struggles to find the right partner for her. Play the clip.
我是爱老师，做爱不恋爱。你们知道台湾有七成以上的人不幸福吗？好险我出生在一个充满爱的家庭。这是我妈，快进来！这是我爸，这是老哥，这是我姐。唉，至于这位。
So look, Simon, I read out that log line and I was like, you know what? This sounds like a good little character drama comedy. It's a Netflix original, and it kind of just the pure nature of the fact that it's Japanese, it's a Netflix original. I couldn't help but think back to a Netflix original from about like 4 or 5 years ago, which, gosh, I'm going to butcher the name of it, but like it's something along the lines of My Husband's Too Big for Me or something like that. It was a similar title to that. No, and that was actually this really sweet Japanese comedy about a relationship, and you see it from the very beginning as they first meet up and then eventually get married and go through quite a number of trials and tribulations, joys and sorrows, just going through it all. Okay, but the gimmick for the show, I guess, was just that she has a smallish vagina and he has a slightly larger penis, and as a result they have a bit of a mixed match
day in day out here. That's all I hear every day, but anyway, do go on.
Yeah, because of your small vagina. Look, that show was incredibly sweet and lovely, and I really kind of wanted the same thing from this. Unfortunately, it's just a little bit flat, and I don't know if this is just one of these tonal issues where it doesn't really quite translate exactly, because obviously when you're watching a TV show or movie from a different language and culture, there are certain elements which don't necessarily always translate. Sometimes as viewers, we elevate things beyond what they actually are. Other times we, you know, just kind of lose out in some context and don't really quite get it. I kind of hope that I'm missing out on something from this one, but it just felt very vanilla and very safe. From the log line, I expected that this was actually just largely about her. Watching the first episode, though, we realize it's actually more of an ensemble, and she's being used more as a framing device for the program. Like, we suddenly see her as a very heavily featured character within this. So it's not like she retreats to the background, but all the other characters are given like their couple of moments to reveal where they're coming from. And it's all from a very sort of sexual relationship sort of standpoint. So it's about the two parents who clearly have some bonding issues. It's about her brother, it's about her sister, and then the titular two. I just want to like this more. It doesn't do much, but look, if you're after a fairly sort of, I'm not going to say ribald, because I don't think the show really sort of goes anywhere particularly extreme, but if you want something that's a little bit maybe sexually frank and a little bit Japanese, give it a go. Outside of that, I think you could probably just do better.
Before you say Japanese again, whoops, too late. It's a Taiwanese story. And the other thing really? I was conscious. Yeah, that's okay.
Why did I think it was Japanese? There was something at the beginning. Okay.
Yeah. The other thing I was conscious of was this is very much in the sort of Netflix mold of, I guess, the template is the show Sex Education, and there's also Sex Life that came about. It takes advantage of its streaming status to often put these quote-unquote provocative or, in some cases, what was your word, ribald show out there. And this one skews very young for me. I would say this is 19 to 24-year-old. Beyond that, we've seen it all before.
Look, I mean, that's certainly true. I actually think that Netflix as a, we'll call them a broadcaster, as a streamer, is actually fairly conservative with its Western programming. I think that when it's got some of the foreign language shows, you'll find that they actually go out there a little bit more. So you did mention Sex Education, which is probably the most frank show that they have that isn't the animated comedy about tweens discovering their bodies. I can't think of the name of that show right now.
With all the voices with Nick Kroll and what's his
and
name?
And Mulaney. Yeah. Yep. So, look, there's certainly those shows, but if you think about some of the foreign language stuff, there's programs like this. There was that aforementioned Japanese show, which was not Taiwanese. The Japanese program, My Husband's Too Big for Me, even though that was actually kind of a sweet drama, it was still had this sort of large issue at the center of it. There was also, I think it was a Polish series from memory called Sexify, which was actually pretty fun, even though I didn't watch more than a couple of episodes, but I probably need to get back to that one because it was, I guess, cheerful TV. But I generally find that they're actually just very safe with their Western programming. It's very rare that you find a lot of nudity. It's very rare you find sort of that much in terms of bad language or graphic imagery on screen. Like, it's just exceptionally safe and vanilla over on Netflix. And I guess maybe if you do want anything that sort of pushes in the margins a bit, we do need to go to some of the foreign language dramas and comedies like this. And look, this isn't a comedy. I thought it'd be actually a bit funnier than it is. It's a light drama.
Yeah, plays very young for my sort of taste. Okay, so it is called Let's Talk About Chew, and it's on the Netflix platform as we speak, which leads us into the intermission.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's intermission time.
Dan Barrett, handing over to you largely for a Dan Barrett Eyewitness News special report here as part of the intermission. There's been a lot of movement on the cable TV front of late. Some news may or may not be about to break here in Australia, and there's certainly been a lot of shifting of the goalposts around the world in the traditional cable industry space. I want you to give me a bit of a rundown, and we haven't had a Dan Barrett deep dive for a long time, and this is really you and your elements, so no rude tweets about what he does here. He does this very well. Tell us what's happening, why it's happening, what the future holds for the cable giants. And I'm putting the stopwatch on because we're on a bit of a timetable today and this could go on for hours, so knock yourself out. Dan Barrett, lead us.
Yes, Simon, I am here on location as we discuss the segment here, coming at you live from my studio where I've been talking to you for the last 20 minutes. Look, Simon, the last couple of weeks I've been thinking a lot about cable television because what we're seeing at the moment, both in Australia, and we're going to use the phrase cable television, but interchange that with the preferred nomenclature of the pay TV companies in Australia, where they like to call it subscription TV. They don't like calling it pay TV. Sure. Apparently that's got some negative connotations. And also, like, we call it cable TV, but in Australia, Foxtel is just as much internet delivered these days, and satellite. In fact, they phased out their cable delivery in Australia, which is kind of a bit interesting. But I've been thinking about cable TV for a little bit because there's some really big shifts happening, but also, and this has been a thing for, you know, since streaming's been around, a lot of reluctance from cable companies and their media owners to really sort of lean hard into streaming purely because you make more money in cable TV. So cable TV as a platform is just been a engine to print some money. The way that it works is that, let's say that you're Disney, for example, that's one of the best examples. They've got ESPN, which is their sports channel, but then they've also traditionally in the past had things like Disney Channel and own like multiple other sort of general entertainment sort of genre channels. Where they make most of their money is from things like ESPN, where they charge a premium to the cable delivery channels to carry ESPN, because as you may be aware, Simon, people love sports, and so people sign up to cable systems based on the fact they've got sports. ESPN traditionally has had most of the sort of big marquee sports, and as such, it's demanded a premium. And if you're a cable subscriber, it was part of the basic package. And so the price that basic package is quite a bit higher because ESPN's part of the mix, and Disney knew they could extract a premium price for that by offering it. So if you are Disney, you don't really want to offer ESPN to customers directly, because customers, you'll sign up for the sports that you're interested in at the end of the season, you'll just head off and do something else, and they don't actually make as much money per head, and you certainly don't actually have as many heads to be extracting money from as well in a streaming space. However, viewers are migrating towards streaming. So if you start looking at the actual figures when we're looking at the streaming versus cable space, if we think about 2013, which was just before we got Netflix here in Australia, so if you can cast your mind back that far, in the US they had about 100 million people paying for, well, 100 million households with cable platforms in their home. Cuts to 2023, 60.5 million. So like over the course of a decade, they've dropped about 40 million homes with cable. Now you can still turn a tidy Good profit Lord. With that, but each year, the speed of people cutting the cable is accelerating that little bit more. And so the amount of money that they were making from something like ESPN, for example, just isn't really quite there anymore. So there's a tipping point that we're heading towards where it actually makes more money for Disney to flip the switch, have ESPN delivered to people's homes in the same way that Hulu or Disney Plus is, rather than be carried on these cable systems. So we've got that element of things. Okay, you've got the fact that the people who are remaining on cable fall into two camps. You've got people who are really into sports. And if you're really into sports, cable TV in the US is the only place you can go for that. All the rights deals are signed up by like your ESPNs or your NBCs, Fox Sports. You know, they've all got like the marquee sports. And if you want them, you can't really go to streaming services for them. So you've got to have your cable subscription if you want access to that. And also, and this is a complaint I hear from some more narky people. I don't think it's really a mainstream concern, but there is a slight delay in streaming. So you've got like about a 60-second delay from if you're watching it versus cable to streaming, which is only really a problem if you're talking to people online at the same time and suddenly everyone in your group chat's going, goal! And you're like, oh, I don't know. Oh! Like, it's a fractured experience if you're doing that, I guess. But if you're just at home watching
the
game. It's
directed at me, isn't it? You're talking about me, aren't you?
I would never be in a group chat with you. Sorry, I got called a prick. I don't really know why that was the case. But you've essentially got sort of some tech issues there. But by and large, cable viewers are sports fans or they are older people. So we're talking about people age 65 plus. And if you look at the demographic breakdowns for who's watching what, as you would absolutely just assume, younger people aren't paying for TV and they're certainly not paying for cable television. The people who are paying for cable television, which they are watching largely linearly, if that's a word, you know, it's a very traditional TV experience. And so as the common sense of it all suggests, older people are generally less tech savvy, and we're looking at an age group who are just less comfortable with going online for their viewing. So they go with where's comfortable, and that's cable TV. And that's fine. It's not really a judgment, but it does mean you've got a situation where people who are like getting close to retirement age and beyond largely just making up the lion's share of this. The sad reality of humanity is that we all die at a certain point. I'm hoping to buck the trend on that one, but we'll see how that plays out. But the reality is if you've got people who are dying off, it means that that pool of people is going to just gradually get smaller and smaller. Unless there's a major pandemic, you're not just going to lose all those viewers at once. Okay, but where you could lose a whole chunk of viewers is if sports suddenly just goes online. Okay, and so why we're talking about that today is because there was the announcement a couple of days ago where Fox, Warner Brothers, Discovery, and Disney are pulling their traditional cable sports channels together to create a digital sporting destination. So you won't be able to get every sport you want if you subscribe to this newly formed joint venture, okay? But you'll be able to get the majority of them, and for sports fans, it's going to be a bit of a must-have. So it's kind of interesting. Now, my own sort of pet theory on this is that as cable companies, we'll call them cable companies, but as like your Disney's, your Warner Brothers, your Foxes of the world are looking at their cable channels, they're thinking, hey, look, we're not going to get rid of our sports rights anytime soon, but we'll continue to deliver them through our digital platforms like Warner Brothers Discovery has Max, Disney have Disney Plus and Hulu, ESPN Plus, all that sort of business. Getting there. They'll probably keep on providing their sports through that and keep negotiating for sports to keep it alive on there. But as they are looking to off-sell their cable channels, because they want to get some sort of money from it eventually as it all falls apart on them, by wrapping it around like this digital product, it actually provides a greater sense of value to that. So they can keep on licensing the sports that are streaming on their other platforms, but put it on these traditional linear channels as well and charge whoever buys them eventually a certain amount of money to have those transmission rights via cable. That's why I think that they're doing this. Wow. But I was just kind of thinking about that, and I was thinking about the Australian context of it all. So in Australia, we've largely got Foxtel. Like, yes, there's Fetch, but that's just a little bit different again. But Foxtel do have like most of the major sports in Australia that aren't on free-to-air TV.
Yes, they do.
But they, I guess, made that digital pivot a couple of years ago by the launch of KO. So already this one company kind of controls sports in that digital space as well as that traditional cable space. And I think it's just kind of interesting thinking about this US move on the same week that in Australia, KO has announced a price increase where the, I'm not sure what the basic package is going up. I think it's going from $25 to $35. And then if you want 4K, it's like an extra $10 on top of that again. But it's, wow. I guess, maybe just sort of interesting as, and like that sounds expensive, but it's not as expensive as getting Foxtel with a sports package on top. And it's certainly not the price that they're paying in the US for it. I think that in Australia, sports fans get a pretty good deal in terms of that KO package, even though that price is going up. But it just kind of, I guess, sort of reemphasizes that Australia really is a fairly different market. And our relationship with having to pay for sports is quite different because we don't have that long-lasting relationship with cable TV. The lack of cable TV as a major viewing platform in Australia really means that we here approach TV in a really different way.
I am never not amazed when we just unleash you on analysis of the TV sector here and around the world, what you're able to impart upon us, Dan Barrett. It really is quite extraordinary to listen to some of your some of the content that you provide with us. So thank you, mate. I think that gives a fairly concise, no, it wasn't concise at all, but it gives a very accurate look at the cable network space here and overseas. So Dan Barrett, round of applause, everyone. Back row, round of applause. Look, no, don't stand up. Sit down, everyone. Sit down.
I would probably say, Simon, I don't know if it was that impressive, but if people know that we had something entirely different planned up until about 15 minutes ago and I had to do that off the top of my head, it wasn't too bad.
It wasn't too bad at all. Let's roll very quickly into what else have you been watching? Let me speak very quickly here. I will get through a couple of little things I've been watching lately. In cinemas last week, but I only caught up with it a couple of days ago, is an absolutely stunning Canadian film called Rice Boy Sleeps. It is the story of a single mother who takes her young son from South Korea to Canada to live, all in 1990. And it is about the periods of growth that they go through that decade. It starts with him as a very little boy struggling to settle into a middle school. It's interesting that it's set in 1990 because that's sort of the last decade before they really started to teach anti-bullying and the impact of you know, casual racism and racism in schools and in workplaces. So it opens the little boy up to this terrible sort of climate where the kids are very tough on him. She is a woman, a fierce woman, packed in a very small body, a very tiny lady, but a very fierce mother who defends what he does. Jump forward nearly 10 years. It's 1999. She still hasn't found another husband. Her husband is left back in South Korea, having passed away. And she is forced to front not only a son who's going a little bit off the rails as a young man, but also the onset of some terrible news, a terminal disease that she's suffering. So this one is an absolute tearjerker. It features half a dozen great, great performances, not least of which is the mother, played by Choi Sung-yoon. This one has won a lot of festival acclaim around the world and is in a handful of cinemas here in Australia through Icon Films. Do get out and see it. Whenever there's this debate about, oh, Barbie didn't get enough nominations or Oppenheimer got all the nominations or this, just remember that most of the films nominated for the Oscars this year and all the award season films are not necessarily the best films of this or any year. There's a lot of films out there that feature extraordinary work by people like those involved with Rice Boy Sleep. So get along and see it if you can. The other one that I saw very quickly, Dan, is Orion in the Dark, which is the new animated film on Netflix. It is very much in the mold of my favorite Pixar film, Inside Out. It's written by Charlie Kaufman and directed by a young guy. I can't remember his name now, but he's terrific. He's done a fantastic job. Sean Sharmitz, who it's his feature film debut, but he's done work on the Trolls movies and the Lego movies as well. But this is a beautiful story of a young boy who's full of fear, makes friends with the Dark, who's this sort of this big sort of goofy kind of character, voiced by Paul Walter Hauser. And what you have is this story of a little boy making his dreams come true by dealing with his fears. And it's a very emotional film and a lot of fun to boot. So two movies that you may not have otherwise heard of this week that are definitely worth checking out, Orion in the Dark and Rice Boy Sleeps.
Yeah, look, definitely a strong vote of support for what you said about the best films often aren't nominated. I didn't see a single nomination for anyone but you. So, Simon, I also want to maybe talk about the TV highlight of maybe this entire year. It is the return of and final season of one of my favorite shows. It's called Curb Your Enthusiasm. Now, Simon, I'm sure you're familiar with this here television program. Well, that was a weird slip.
Yes.
I tell you what, not
passionately. I have certainly watched it over the years, but there are gaps in my viewing that I haven't seen. So yeah, and I love, of course, what I've seen, as anyone who does. But no, I haven't. It's not one of those must-watch shows for me.
Yeah. So look, I guess maybe why I wanted to talk about it is I found something really just interesting about the comedic rhythms of this return episode and the way that viewers have responded to it. So I just saw a lot of commentary about the show just wasn't really as funny as it usually is. Meanwhile, I found it to be absolutely sort of belly-ripping hilarious. And I think the reason why I was maybe more into it than a lot of my pals in my group chat who watched the episode is purely because every night when I go into the kitchen and start cooking, I'll usually watch an episode of Curb Your Enthusiasm. It's a very easy show to sort of have in the background because it's so low stakes and almost sketch-based to a certain degree. You can watch half an episode and then come back to one a few days later and be able to just pick it up, and it's not really a concern at all. It's like a perfect cooking program. I have to watch it with headphones on because I've got a little one around and I don't want to hear some of the language and adult concepts in the program. So that's a
plus. You don't want to hear her screaming for help if she's hungry or if she's in trouble. You don't want that interrupting your TV viewing.
Yeah, as if that was ever a concern. But look, I think because I do watch this show just on the regular, the two things. One, I'm used to the fact that the first episode back is rarely ever the best episode of the season. Like, it usually takes, it's not like the show does a lot of setup, but it does a lot of setup in terms of establishing the comedic sensibilities of the program. And they do that every year. And so when I saw the first one back and it wasn't quite as great as I know other episodes this season will be, not really much of a surprise. And two, if you've been away from the comedic rhythms of the show for a couple of months or haven't watched it since it was last on TV, like, it just takes a lot of time to get back into the very specific, curmudgeonly nature of that program. But anyway, Curb Your Enthusiasm, I had a great time with the return, and I'm very much looking forward to the last remaining episodes of the series.
Very exciting. Good for you. Curb Your Enthusiasm season, what did we get to, 12? That's
we're
pretty
12,
extreme.
Yeah.
It's better than, longer than Seinfeld. Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah, fewer episodes.
All right, Dan
though.
Barrett. That's true. Very true. Let's look in the rearview mirror for this day's... I'll try that again. Let's look in the rearview mirror for In History. We really need a better name for that segment.
Because I name the segment repeatedly. Every week I tell you the name of that segment. That is your segment that you created, and you can never bother to learn the name of the segment. It is called This Week in History. It explains it all right in there.
That actually makes a lot of sense. Have you, and you've mentioned that before? You have? I don't recall you mentioning that before. This Week in History. Okay. If you want to tweet about Dan's behavior, go right ahead. February 10, 1993, when she spoke to him in this primetime special, it drew 90 million viewers and a 39.3 Nielsen rating. So who are she and him?
Look, I'm taking a very massive stab here. I'm just thinking about the year that this is and who, like, the biggest people were that might be featured in an interview where lots of people might watch. So I'm going to go out there and say Barbara Walters as the she and Michael Jackson as the him.
Oh, half a point.
Ooh,
Michael Jackson was the him, but she was Oprah Winfrey.
Ah. Yeah, that makes sense.
Primetime special. There you go. February 13, 1997, which profile of America's number three pornographer won the Golden Bear at the Berlin Film Festival?
Well, look, I mean, I don't know that he's America's number three pornographer. And also, I'm kind of curious.
Where does he rate on your list of pornographers?
Oh, he's obviously, nah. Like, I'm presuming this is The People versus Larry Flint.
That's exactly what it was. Well done. Yeah. February 16, 2005, the UK version of The Apprentice premieres with which British magnate in the role made famous by Donald Trump?
Now, I presume this is the same turkey that they brought out for the Australian version, at which point I can tell you that his name is Lord...
If you mumbled Alan Sugar there, yes, you would have been right. Lord Alan Sugar took over from the racist misogynist who hosted the American version. So well done. You got two and a half out of three right. That's pretty good. Okay. That brings us to the birthday quiz. Doo-dah, doo-dah.
No, not happy birthday. No, not that. Please, no. Not happy birthday.
Right. I think you're going to get this. I think there's at least two in there that are dead set giveaways. February 10, 1997, the beautiful Chloe Grace Moretz. February 11, 1992, the beautiful Taylor Lautner. February 12, 1980, Christina Ricci. And February 13, 1951, a young actor called David Norton, who's really famous for only one film. Well, two if you're including Ski School. But this is the film that he's most famous for. What do those four birthday buddies all have in common?
I'm really not too sure.
If you can pick the two guys, which you should be able to.
Well, I feel that Taylor Lautner. Okay, so this is where my brain is at on it. So Taylor Lautner, I'm pretty sure, was one of the fellas in the Twilight. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah, so exactly. I'm pretty sure he was like the werewolf. Is that correct?
Was he now? Didn't know you were a Twilight fan. Sure, okay.
Well, I mean, I'm not. I saw like the first like 15 minutes of the first one and realized that was kind of enough, but I believe that's him. So I think the vampires sparkle. I don't know what the werewolves did. That'll be him. If you're saying David Norton, who I'm very much unfamiliar with, was famous for one thing really, and it's the 1950s. Then it's probably he was maybe starring in I Was a Teenage Werewolf or something similar of that sort of nature.
No, he was so born in the 1950s, you knucklehead.
Was that?
Yeah, he was born in the 1950s.
Oh, born in the 1950s. So coming to his own in the 70s.
You're on the right path. You're on the right path.
I'm trying to work out what sort of werewolf things there were in the 70s. Teen Wolf was Michael J. Fox in 85. David Norton, not too sure. Putting a pin in that one.
Screaming at their headphones now.
Chloe Grace Moretz, like, I'm just not too sure. I mean, I know who she is, obviously, but I can't think of any sort of werewolf thing she was in. And Christina Ricci, known for like Adam's Family, but I mean, she obviously appeared besides like certainly very hairy characters.
I'm tempted to give it to you because you're on the right track. You've got the answer.
I know I'm in the ballpark here.
Around with the details.
Yeah, I just don't know. I'm not sure. I'm walking around the park and I'm trying to look in.
Taylor Lautner was best known for playing werewolf Jacob Black in the Twilight Saga film series.
Obviously.
And David Norton, many of us will remember David Norton as maybe one of cinema's, or definitely one of cinema's most iconic werewolves, David Kessler in John Landis's American Werewolf in London.
Simon, you know what's hilarious about this? I watched the closing credits of that movie just last night.
Oh my goodness me. Well, that was him. Now, the other two, Chloe Grace Moretz, she played a rebellious teen called Carolyn Stoddard, who's revealed in a last-minute twist, sorry if I spoiled this for anyone, as a werewolf in Tim Burton's Dark Shadows movie from about a decade ago. Oh. And Christina Ricci starred opposite Jesse Eisenberg in Wes Craven's much maligned and troubled production called Cursed as a survivor of a werewolf attack who's gradually on the turn. So you were right. They're all werewolves, but a little bit of some left field details there. So well done, Dan Barrett. Good job.
But also I said I can't think of any movies from the 1970s with werewolves, and the most obvious one was just sitting right in front of my wolfy nose.
81 for American Werewolf in London. So you did.
Okay.
All right. Well done. What a good show. You know, you were less prickish this week, and I think that's going to be reflected in the comments on social. So good for you. You've taken to heart what men have said, and I appreciate that.
I know. I think I've gone out there and said some pretty terrible things. And don't get me started on manners. I don't know who manners is. I'm sure they're lovely.
You can follow us on all our socials, Screen Watching on Facebook at Screen Watching Podcast, on Threads and YouTube, both the same handle at Screen Watching. And you can email us with your thoughts on Dan's personality, screenwatchingpodcast@gmail.com.
Folks, if you want to follow me very specifically, don't. Is probably my best advice. I like to be left alone. But if you want to read my newsletter, feel free to do that. You can find that one at alwaysbewatching.com. Also, I'm around on the socials. I do all sorts of things. Oh, wait, what's that newsletter about? Oh, it's about the latest news in TV and streaming just generally and like other random stuff you find on screens. I'm on various socials. You can find me at the Dan Barris on your Threads, on your Blue Skies. I'm on the X. I was close to getting back on the X/Twitter this week, and then Common Sense gripped me and I haven't done it, but maybe Blue Sky. That's probably the best place to find me of late, I think.
Good idea. My writings are over on screen-space.net, and for our Melbourne listeners, the Melbourne Science Fiction Film Festival, my little endeavour is happening at Cinema Nova, February 23 to 25. Go to the Nova website or our website, to see all the films playing, some good ones amongst them as well. Dan Barrett, fantastic show. Well done. All done with a very buoyant spirit. And I appreciate that, my friend.
Can I ask a question? I went to the Sydney Science Fiction Film Festival in Melbourne last year. How does that differ to the Melbourne Science Fiction Film Festival?
Mostly by name. I know you went to the Brisbane screenings of the Melbourne season of the Sydney Science Fiction Film Festival. It was in all the papers. You probably read about it. But yes, I got to have a word with your buddies at Angelica. I'm trying to get in there and they haven't returned my emails as yet. So hopefully I'll be able to make some announcements about that soon because I understand it's a hell of a theatre.
Okay. I would like to close out this podcast with a story about me going to the Angelica Theatre because it is proof that the system works. Yeah. Okay. So I went and saw the aforementioned Anatomy of a Fall at the cinema. It was a Sunday afternoon. I did this two Sundays ago. I got home. I started re-engaging with the world. And then about like maybe 2 to 3 hours, this is like certainly mid evening. So we'll say like 7:30, 8 o'clock ish. I get a phone call from the Angelica Theatre and they said, "Hi, did you leave some AirPods behind?" And I said, did I? And they're like, "You did, because on my AirPods, I got my thing engraved." I was annoyed at the time because I thought, well, why would I pay to get my number like engraved on my AirPods? And then I actually lost my AirPods and the people at the Angelica found them on my chair and said, "Hey, Dan, come and pick them up." So I went and did that the next day. And, you know, it was a good news story being reunited with my technology. But anyway, big thanks to the people at Angelica for making the phone call.
That's so beautiful, Dad.
It really was.
It's really lovely. Let's end it now. I got to get a tissue.
Yeah. Get it. Okay. Sure. Folks, this has been Screen Watching. We'll be back next week. Simon, I won't have sign off because he's clearly busy with his tissues. Folks, we'll see you next week.